Communication with the whales and the dolphins is the greatest achievement that the human race can aspire to. In the province of dreamtime, there are no limits. The mind is infinite. Communication. Dreamtime.
You're listening to Dolphinville Radio. This is your host, Dolphinus. Welcome aboard.
All right. Here we are. What's the name of this park that we're sitting at right now?
Onikahakaha Beach Park.
Onikahakaha. This is where I was with Michael Heisen at Paradise Newland putting on a presentation here on the Hilo side of the Big Island of Hawaii to celebrate the idea that the cetaceans who had been here for their winter were now getting ready to go back to their summer home, their summer vacation spot, after being home and giving birth. So here we are. We're kind of rejoining. If you hear a dull roar in the background, that's the sound of the surf pounding against the rocks here. Michael and Paradise are friends from a good 5-6 years ago now, and our common connection has been John Lilly. Their connection with John Lilly we'll go into with this, and mine kind of come from the same base. John was the father of the cetacean-human connection.
The largest brains on this planet are in the ocean. The ocean.
And we all found something, a major truth in his words, and have allowed it to lead us to this place.
Communication with the whales and the dolphins is the greatest achievement that the human race can aspire to.
So welcome you guys, Michael, Paradise, welcome.
Thank you, Jeff.
This is Dolphinville Radio. And just for our listening audience, this is a service, a public service that's being broadcast for free on Dolphinville.com radio, and Photon.net is our service provider that's doing that for us. So welcome to the show, you guys.
Thank you.
Let's start with Paradise. You were the first one that kind of like found the Big Island to be the magnetic pole for the research and the work ahead. Take us back to the eclipse year of 1991 and what made you, gave you the impetus to say this was the place we want to come?
That's a good question, Douglas. We had just relocated the Sirius Institute to Maui from California, where we had initiated it, Michael and myself in particular. And shortly after we got to the Eel Valley Lodge, I met a lady there who came over from the Big Island and was just telling us about these wonderful free dolphins at this black sand beach. And Hawaii being so new to me and to us, and the idea of free dolphins was still quite a novelty, I felt like, oh, this is really good. Maybe we'll go to the Big Island. And then I heard about the great eclipse of 7/11/91. And when I heard about that, I was inspired to relocate the Institute to the Big Island to be there in time for the eclipse and to record the dolphins before, during, and after this eclipse to see what they had to say. Because my mind said, well, they must have something going on, and I wonder if anyone's ever thought to find out what changes during an eclipse time. So that was the impetus that brought us here several months later, and true to the reality or the vision, if you will. Tiger, my son, and I came over first, and then Michael came over a few days later, and then our partner Charles Lucy came over and joined us, and we wound up making our way down to the Black Sand Beach on the east coast of the island to be there in time for the eclipse. And from there, I should let Michael pick up a little bit, which is also, the story is available on planetpuna.com, the Big Eclipse Report, which is pretty remarkable what happened.
Well, we'll talk about planetpuna.com, which is the website, and also the host for the Sirius Institute. Before, Michael, you tell us your story, or maybe you can lead into your story by explaining what is the Sirius Institute, Sirius being the star, not seriously, folks.
Right. Well, the Sirius Institute was founded by Paradise some years ago as part of the Sirius Connection, and it had as its major goal the dolphinization of the planet, which was to integrate the cetacea into our own societies again, like we've had in the past, and to extend that with the proper technology and other communication gear that we have. And when I came along and met her at John Lilly's birthday party in 1990, I had come off of kind of a walkabout through the Southwest, and I was thinking things about dolphins, birth, habitats, communication, all that. And I read her journals, and it's like I could have written them. So I thought, well, this must be a cosmic setup. I meet her at John Lilly's birthday party, and she's writing things that I could have said out of my head right now. So we got together to do this, make it real. Paradise developed it as a movie script first, which she can talk about better. In any case, it looked like a good thing to make real and just go ahead with. And so we did. We wrote a small grant proposal to the Grateful Dead to do an interspecies concert between the humans and the dolphins and the whales. And we sent it off to them officially. They said, nice proposal. We're a little busy right now. So we put it up on a bulletin board system called BIC, Byte Information Exchange. And this wonderful man named Jim Kent said, well, I'd like to support that, which got us a small grant that managed to move everything to Hawaii. And we've been here pretty much ever since. Right. And to bring things full circle, around the time of the great eclipse, 7/11/91, we were informed that, according to even such a knowledgeable source as Paul Harvey on his news broadcast, the Grateful Dead were going to come to the Big Island to play for the great eclipse.
Wow.
And we were invited to be the dolphin part of that. And we thought it was all going to go. We met a fellow, for example, who was going to drive their equipment around and things like that. And it just looked like it was going.
Wow.
Everything changed.
Oh.
It rained for 5 days straight. Oh. The Grateful Dead did something else. And
it was crowded on our side of the island.
Right,
we saw everything.
Yeah.
But shoot a farm with the dolphins, as soon as you think it's hardwired, it changes.
Yeah.
We're already so much familiar with that, even at a distance.
Mm-hmm. So. Now, tell me a little bit about your background with John Lilly.
I was a TV producer and talk show host with my own program in Vancouver, British Columbia for several years. My cameraman had been recruited to go down, by Joan Halifax, by the way, to go down and film the month-long presentation of The Legend of the Golden Dolphin at the Ojai Foundation.
Peter Shenstone.
Exactly. And he came back all excited, Steve Rideout did, and said, my name at the time was Renee, but he said, I've met these wonderful dolphin people, I met the Lilies, I met all these other wonderful people there, and I've set you up to meet them and to interview them and everything. And that was the beginning of my official connection with the Lilies, was through that. Some months later, about a month later, I was on business in San Diego, called up to the Lily Pad, as it was called, spoke with Barbara Clark, then became Barbara Lilly, in Malibu. And she talked with Tony Lilly and said, all right, you can come up. I mean, like, I'm one of many thousands of journalists who wanted to meet them. But she said, okay, you can come up and meet with Tony today. And so I did. It turns out we had a wonderful rapport right from the very beginning. And because I was a TV producer and working on these documentaries about interspecies communications, water birthing with dolphins, and the flotation experience, how these all connected to each other. I was working on a 3-part documentary. She invited me to work with them, and she made all of their material and information available to me. And that was the beginning of a really deep friendship and mentorship, and we just had this wonderful connection.
Well, that's a vital body of information that John Lilly certainly brought to the public's mind. And eventually, I think it was in 1961, he actually coined the phrase the Cetacean Nation as a reference that here is a sentient race of beings on the planet Earth, and it's time that we started recognizing them as that. And part of what brought me into this full force of the Cetacean Nation was John's idea that we have to begin to think in terms of a planetary consciousness and another sentient race besides humans occupying this space. And, of course, that's what pulled me into it. And so thank you, John Lilly. When I met John at the end of his life, it was a real experience. And it was amazing to be around him. Yeah. Now, you met John and you spent time with John as well, correct, Michael?
Yes. I read his books when I was about 12 or 13. And that convinced my brother to get a job training dolphins in Texas. So I got to go hang out with the dolphins for a whole summer.
Wow.
And that was confirmed everything that I knew about them then. And I was
so you're in the water at 14,
yeah.
13, 14 years
yeah.
old.
Hours at
and didn't you have an experience at that time?
Oh, man, many.
So something quite significant when you were 14.
Oh, well, just to meet a 800-pound dolphin in the water was pretty significant.
That would be significant.
And then one of the tricks I was expected to do was to climb up on this 20-foot platform and stick my head out with a fish in my mouth and then look straight down at this 800-pound dolphin that's going to about come and get the fish out of your mouth.
Rocketing out of the water.
They zoom around in a circle and into a full bank and then somehow do this dive and jump. And pretty soon they're coming right at your head, and you think, boy, if I flinch, but if I zero flinch, they could go right through my head.
That's right.
But the reality is that they're so precise that the dolphin comes and he's at top dead center of his jump, within about 2 inches of your mouth, and he very gently, while he's has zero relative velocity to you, just reaches over and gently grabs the fish out of your mouth, and then turns and falls back into the water, nose first, with hardly a splash.
Yes.
But it's really exciting.
So that's extraordinary. And that was your first experience.
Yes. And I guess the overall was they were such fun. They were just joyous and fun. And they accepted me, at least, with all the warts and things I had.
Mm-hmm.
I found them to be almost the first sane beings I'd ever met. We got to be great friends and had a whole summer together, and that got me hooked.
Well, you went into from 14 years old, you went through the academia into a scientist role.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about some of the things, the areas of science. I know that you work in the NASA program, and you were involved in sonic technologies and so on and so forth. How did you get into that, and how did it lead you back to the dolphins?
Oh, well, it's kind of a long loop, but I started out in state biology, went through pre-med, ecology, chemistry, and I always wanted to work with dolphins. That turned out to be harder to arrange than I thought. So I eventually ended up specializing in what they call neurobiology, studying perception of the brain, and got a PhD in that. I did a computer model of the retina of the eye, and then a postdoc at California Institute of Technology, Caltech, on eye movements. And then along the way, I'd always been interested in space, especially when I was in Florida. I got to see a Saturn V go from 3 miles away, for example, that night.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
I always wanted to get to orbit. I watched all the shots going off when I was a kid. And so Jet Propulsion Labs was right next to Caltech. So long story short, I ended up doing some things with NASA and Jet Propulsion Labs and two private rocket companies. Primary project at JPL was electrostatic levitation, we called it. I got to fly zero-g parabolas. And then helped out with two private rocket companies. And basically, we made a pretty good shot. We managed to test the first private rocket in the United States. It happened to blow up. We developed single-stage orbit rocket concepts. We had tourist concepts, all sorts of things for Pacific American Launch Systems. And then various things happened. That all fell apart, and I was sent the plans for orbit were on hold. I was looking around for the next thing I ought to be doing.
Being able to prove it. Yeah. It's kind of interesting because it seems like, as we talked about earlier, that timing is everything. And as you started out with your interest in neural processing and got a PhD in that, Parallel to that, you also were an expertise in neuro-linguistic processing. And so the two of you have come together with a new concept on how to sculpt woods. You want to talk a little bit about sound sculpture and what you've been doing over the last 20 years with that?
Well, yeah. In December 1987, I was writing, 1986 rather, December 23rd to be exact, because today is 11/23. I was writing on the Dolphins came and said I would create a new style of writing that was holographic in essence.
Mm.
And that's all they said. And I said, well, that sounds fun. And I was still pretty new to the Dolphins, having just hooked up with the Lilies a year or so earlier, 3 years earlier.
Now, how does this information come? You know, everyone has a different way of receiving stuff. Did it come as a bubble of thought?
Well, it's very interesting. I had these dolphin shines in my apartment in Vancouver. And when it was time for me to get a message showing the dolphins, even though the windows were shut because it was wintertime, the chimes would start moving. I said, okay, time to get me to the typewriter, because this was kind of pre-computer days, really,
mm-hmm.
and sit down and be ready to receive the information. The words just flowed through me.
Okay.
They just said that, and then the rest of the communication came through, which was more personal information,
mm-hmm.
that relationship. Over the next few months, I started to watch what was happening with communications, and I developed a different kind of sensitivity. It's like I was listening for something different from that time on. I had a deck of what was called the Course in Miracle cards, which, you know, my friends and I would pull a card and do the reading kind of thing. But I was aware that there was something about it that bothered me, and it bothered me pretty extensively. And what it was that part of the card message would be really nice, but then there would be this other kind of communication that felt yucky, is the best way to describe it. It would say something like, remember that life is a wonderful experience, and don't be afraid to live it fully. So it's like, well, what does that mean? Either it's wonderful, or I need to be afraid to live it fully. It's like there were two conflicting messages. So one day in the springtime, I took the deck of cards, and I went through the whole deck, and did what we now call, I sculpted the deck.
Mm-hmm.
I made every communication clear. I made everyone sound coherent, in other words, or to create a coherent thought form, which led me to develop some of the principles of language sculpting,
mm-hmm.
and that we communicate mm-hmm. through pictures, we communicate vibrationally,
mm-hmm.
we communicate telepathically, all of us, all the time. Now, it's just a question of, how are we receiving this, and how readily are we receiving? When I receive telepathic communications from the dolphins, they're very clear.
Mm-hmm.
They zero say, life is wonderful, don't be afraid. It's like, they say, life is wonderful, stop. Okay, that's the clear thought form I can get. I receive that purely. This became a model for how language sculpting was to develop its concept, which is creating coherent realities through the conscious use of language.
Mm-hmm.
Dolphins are conscious breathers. That means every time they breathe, they have to be aware. They have to be conscious about it. We're autonomic breathers. We just keep breathing whatever's going on unless we stopped breathing and we're dead or something severe happens. But basically, we keep breathing. The way for us, then, our route to consciousness is to be conscious in our thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Language sculpting provides us a framework whereby we can be conscious by referencing what we call common usage of the language,
mm-hmm.
which are all the not words, the not phrases.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to miss my flight, which is common usage of the language. We would sculpt that transitionally, let's say, to I zero want to miss my flight. So at least now we're realizing, we're wanting to come to the moment. And when we say I zero this or I zero that, then boing, what a powerful tool to come into the present.
Right on.
And in that present moment, we're in like in a 360 bubble again. It's like, well, if I zero want that, what do I want?
Mm-hmm.
So then, well, I want to catch my flight and I want my luggage to make it too. That's the complete transition from the common usage to the zero point, if you will,
mm-hmm.
to conscious usage or language sculpting, which is whole brain thinking, for example.
Absolutely.
It gives us the outcome we say we want. It creates a coherent field. We have we have had two brains, partly because all those knots throughout our language, throughout our linguistic history from birth, pre-birth actually, starts with the mom saying and the dad saying, I don't want to get pregnant. A lot of us, a lot of the people on the planet came through. that way with the not wanting to get pregnant. So right away, we start out with knots throughout our energy body, throughout our energy field. And I was sculpting Ralph Blum's Book of Rune Cards many years ago. And what I had was a vision before this started of our brain actually entangling all those little neurons. We're getting all knotted up because all we had were knots all around us. 40 to 50,000 times before the age of five. From birth to five, the average child hears this. 40 to 50,000 times. So linguistically, it literally ties up how a child interacts with its physicality. If we tell a child not to do something, and they're wiring in doing things like walking, don't walk over there, you'll fall and get hurt, don't carry the milk, you'll spill it, all these not things, we're creating confusion and difficulty for that child, or all of us really, to function fully in physicality, because we're getting all this conflicting information. Don't run across the street, you'll get hit by a car. Well, the platform that the child is getting is run across the street, I'll get hit by the car, and then this creates tremendous confusion.
Wasn't it said the universe doesn't hear not? And, of course, the neuro-linguistic programming is bringing in some of the points that you're talking about. It's become quite wide used in business and in private practice. I love the metaphor and the symbol of zero itself, too, because to me in mathematics, as you all know, Michael, zero is not just the lack of something, but it is both the lack and everything at once. So that's the true zero point that we're talking about. And there's something in the Dalton messages that helps us to conceptually, in our bodies, feel what it's like to be in that zero point energy. Now, we've used a not form of description by saying unconditional love. But when in fact what we're doing is describing the purest essence of love, which has no agenda beyond itself, has no expectations beyond what it is. And this is really a point of consciousness that I think that we all would like to see happen on the planet. And we're all moving in our own ways to try to get that to go on. Okay, let's jump back to 1991. This is like we're talking 14 years now. So what's evolved out of this Sirius Institute over that time?
We have become very well established on our side of the island in particular. For our work, through our dolphin research, when you say my name or Michael's name, automatically people think dolphin, which is a good linkage, because then we're known throughout the field, if you will, from the governor's office to our congressman, to our mayor's office, to our county, all these institutions and agencies and areas where what we want to do needs to be recognized and acknowledged. So that's the first thing, is we've established ourselves. And we've established ourselves as the dolphin people. Mm-hmm. And the dolphin people who want to establish a dolphin-attended water and natural gentle birthing center. Mm-hmm. A lot of our work, a lot of my work in particular, going to all these meetings and all this, has to do with putting the word out about birth, mm-hmm. about limbic imprint, about what does it mean to be born into the world like the Hawaiians have been for thousands of generations or hundreds of generations, actually with the sands of their birth at hand. Because I was born in a hospital in Manhattan in the middle of the winter, I had zero sands of my birth. So in some way, a connectivity that other cultures, for example, indigenous cultures, have as a natural part of their being was lacking in me. And the same thing for virtually anyone of my generation and my culture. We were born and we were faced by bright lights glaring, bare-bottomed spanked. All the machinations and the mechanical birthing things that created a limbic imprint that filtered through my entire life. And a big component of this was the feeling of separation. This is what I felt at birth. Although ultimately my own healing had to do with recognizing that it was the illusion of separation, the myth of separation, because the truth of it is, of course, we're all still connected. Even if I'm on the outside now, I'm still part of my mom's energy, I'm still part of the Gaia's energy. But it took a long time to get past that loneliness. And my first real dolphin encounter, before I met Joe and Rosie through the Human Dolphin Foundation and Roberta Goodman at the time, back in March of 85, was with the dolphins at the in St. Augustine facility in Florida. first I saw their show, and I saw maybe a dozen dolphins, doing these remarkable things, jumping together and swimming together and leaping and everything. It was just like my heart was ready to burst. I was so thrilled.
Mm-hmm.
I was so full of
They have an effect on most people, I must say.
Yes. And I felt something very deep and primal inside of me, like this was so familiar, and yet it was truly the first time I'd ever seen it. And then after that show, we went around and saw the dolphins in their pens, and three of them were in one pen playing catch with each other. I thought, wow, this is just amazing. Because I saw dogs, you know, if you throw a frisbee or a ball, they'll catch it, but they don't throw it back to you. They might bring it back, but this was a whole different level of engagement. And then, much to my great amazement, they threw the ball to me. I thought, oh my God, they want me to play catch with them. And so I did, but it was more like I felt that they knew me. I felt that somehow, and I felt my deep feeling self, that they recognized me, mm-hmm. that they remembered me, mm-hmm. that they knew me, mm-hmm. and they wanted to play ball with me. Mm-hmm. This was my invitation to really join life and to play ball with them.
How interesting.
And it profoundly changed me.
Can do that.
It did. And in part, I realized later, as this processing took place over a long period of time, that they brought me in from the cold, so to speak.
There's an interesting phenomenon that happens with swimming with the wild dolphins, as we call them, or the free-swimming dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
On the Kona side, they will play what they do in nature with one another, is they'll pick up an object, such as a leaf, something natural to the ocean, and they will play with that. Mm-hmm. They'll use it as decoration, and you've seen the films of them doing this.
Mm-hmm.
The significant thing is that they will engage humans in this game of catch and fetch.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me that it's more than just the child's game of I'm leaving it, you pick it up, you leave it, I'll pick it up, which was the nature of the game. When I thought to myself, well, there's something else going on here energetically. It's a very subtle form of communication, obviously, the body language, the acceptance, and all the things that you just mentioned. But even subtler than that, which is where the dolphins have led me into the subtle realms of understanding, was that it was literally impossible for humans to touch the dolphins directly. Energetically, it's dangerous for them. They don't have the skin for it, the human oils, the fingernails, it can cause bacteria. Plus, I got to thinking that even more subtle than that, aside from the biological reasons, there's a subtle energy reason. Our frequency bands don't really quite match up to theirs. Now, we're talking the spinner dolphins here, not the bottlenose. Bottlenose are much bigger, heftier guys, and they've shown themselves to be the hardy species to work with humans. They've become the service dolphins for that reason. But the spinners are demure, they're very shy, and they're not used to... In fact, they've never been held in captivity because they'll die. And by the way they die, they stop breathing. They go to the bottom, and boom, it's over, they check out. They haven't the same sensibility of life and death as we do. But without getting into that, it became obvious to me that what they were demonstrating was that by this exchange, there was the medium of the leaf that could introduce the subtle energies mm-hmm. of exchange. So they would pick up a leaf, they'd put in their little spin, they'd drop it, we'd put in our little spin, taking up theirs, leaving ours, they'd bring it back, and thereby having a conversation on the most subtle, beautiful, vibrational level. Mm-hmm. And then what happens? You come out, you have this euphoric feeling, you're lightheaded, something is just changed in your life energetically, and I call it lovingly the endorphin effect takes over, and we feel really good about ourselves, and we feel connected whole brain to the world.
Mm-hmm.
These are the objectives that we've all experienced. Maybe when you were 14 and had that opportunity, some vibration was happening in the water.
Absolutely.
We know it was a conductive, water's conduction, and we know that energy is really the thing that defines all of existence. And as waveforms of description, as we begin to know more about such things, and scientifically we can measure more and more narrower bands and seeing these subtle frequencies going down to infinity one way, and what do you know, they go to infinity in the other way, and here we are right in the middle, and there's a dynamic of waveform activity, which has been discovered, or rediscovered, and has certain properties. It's been described as spiral dynamics most recently, in its recent incarnation, as to how energy moves and energy being consciousness moves through time and space. Nassim Haramein, who's my neighbor and was a previous guest on the show, went into elaborate detail in his description on taking Einstein's theorem and taking it the next step. here's what Einstein describes as the universe, here's that description moving through time and space.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you know, it's a nice spiral dynamic
spin.
That we can all identify with. So the dolphins, in their own way, by blowing bubbles at the dolphinarium in Oahu around the time of the eclipse, when you decided to move here, were demonstrating a dynamic form of energy, the tube torus, the donut, that was being made visible out of something invisible, so that we, lame-brained humans, could have a demonstrable example of what it looks like to really communicate with another being. That's what I got anyway at that time.
You're listening to Dolphinville Radio, dolphinville.com.
So part of my realization is there is a balance point, and part of what we're being demonstrated to us is this whole brain mechanism. What does it look like to be using both hemispheres in coordination, in harmony, rather than the old tried and true piston-like action, shifting right, left, right, left, right, left. Our whole society has been based on that binary system, and we came to believe and were shown that that was the only way it was. We know better now. And so we're here to language new ways of interpreting that particular action. And the dolphins are standing by going, yeah, we applaud you. We've been waiting for 3,000 years for you to get back to it.
Yeah.
And so we're all laughing, and that's really part of the joy that we're experiencing, because we all know. And I think a lot of the people listening to this program are going to be smiling to themselves going, yeah, I knew it was something like that. It's more than what's in the textbook.
Well, a lot of people listening today will have already been likely experiencing dreams and meditations where the dolphins are coming in. We even got an email a few weeks ago from a lady who's a therapist with some children in the Midwest, and the dolphins were coming through her channeling to help her provide, you know, that kind of thinking into her care of the children. It's different than that we actually have to be with them physically, although that's wonderful to be sure. It's enough to understand that their reach is very extensive, and invoking them in prayer and meditation and dream time is very, very powerful, and we can experience it at a distance.
Well, they're etheric in nature. Mm-hmm. I think we can all agree on that. And in that etheric nature can transcend any limitations that we have put on time and space. So the dream time, which is a fascinating aspect to our being, mm-hmm. and the least understood because we can't document it. We have an idea that when our eyes do this at night, that we go into this space and something happens, and if we wake somebody up, they'll have some story mm-hmm. that will be associated with what their mind was projecting. But what's really going on? What do you think is going on, Michael?
Oh, boy. Well, I think there's an overlap between the dream world and reality.
Of course.
And at least by the Aboriginal point of view, there's dream time and now, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the best example, having been with the dolphins when I was 14, and I met Mitzi, the original flipper. We had a dolphin project with Hank Truby. I worked with him for 12 years. He was Lily's linguist, and I did all this science along linguistics and trying to get communication going with dolphins and so on. So I got to swim with Florida and Liberty dolphin for days at a time sometimes, twin engines, one dolphin in each hand. We were going all around the pond all night under a full moon one night. It was just marvelous.
Not time they're shooting you with their vibration.
And I remember at the time, my mental state was, I just want to be like a dolphin.
Yeah.
So show me your rules. Let me play by your rules and show me what you have. And one day they came by and hugged me between them. They came at me about 20 mile an hour, throwing rooster tails off all their surfaces. And I was a little like, whoa.
Yes.
And they came and one sort of took me on the shoulder and the other on the hip. They rolled me in a little ball, took me down about 20 feet. While rolling me in a little ball, they were hugging me together, you know, hugging between them. And I'm getting whirled around as long as I could hold my breath. And then they brought me to the surface, turned me loose. I'm a little dizzy. And that was my initiation into their pod. I was part of their pod.
Sure.
Because before that, it might be hard to, like, look at their blowhole or something.
Sure.
They're very protective of those areas.
Uh-huh.
And after that, I could grab them by the flukes and drag them backwards, roll them around on their stomach, tickle their belly, look at their blowhole.
Mm-hmm.
I could be out there for as long as I wanted until I got tired. And apparently other people, I only learned this years later, other people in the dolphin project there could only swim with them for about 20 minutes before the dolphins drove them out. So I've had all those experiences. And then there was a long, roughly 15-year time of aerospace work, which is, we'll have to talk about that some other time. But when a lot of the rocket projects ended, I was looking to get back to the dolphins. So I ended up in Florida on our way to Dolphins Plus. And I had this amazing lucid dream about 2 days before I got there, where I was swimming with a dolphin in the dark, and it was all in a very bright lucid dream. And I wake out of this and wondering where that was. Like, where is here? Where was that? And I want to go back. And about 2 days later, I'm at the facility, and this dolphin, I just walked over to see another dolphin than the ones I had swum with, put my fingers, wiggled them in the water, and this dolphin did a figure eight across the pond, came up and touched the tips of my fingers, and then rubbed her body across my fingers with very sensuous, close, loving things. And it usually takes something like 3-4 months to get that close even to a service dolphin that you're good friends with. And so this was just blowing my mind, like, what's going on? And at some point, I looked in her eye and said, oh, I get it. You're the one in the dream.
Ah.
And, you know, I'm kind of scooping my brains up off the pavement.
Yeah.
And they're shoveling us out. And I'm
sure.
Going, putt, putt, putt.
Yeah, right.
Well, long story short, I've been talking to one of the trainers about their telepathy and how he had trained them for 25 years using telepathic images, if you will. He would think up something he wanted the dolphins to do and just sort of ship them the image.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if they wanted to, they'd do it for him in about 10 minutes. He'd been doing that for 25 years. And being scientific and skeptical, I was skeptical at that point. But I listened to this.
Surely.
So that night, it so happens that I swam with this dolphin all night. And
For real.
So the first...
Reenacted the dream.
Yeah, the dream came true.
Wow.
Across them. And among other things,
after all.
You know,
right.
And then just to wrap it all up, many things happened. We were swimming together closely, and about 3 or 4 times I got cold, and she somehow warmed me up somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how. All I know is I had energy right after she did something. And every time I get cold, she'd do that. So that happened like 3 or 4 times that night. And then... at one point, I thought, okay, if you guys are telepathic, I'm a little tired, come over here and be next to me for a while so I can look at your blowhole and things like that. And it was like 2 seconds, 1001, 1002. She came over and stayed next to me for about 20 minutes, half hour.
Mm-hmm.
Hardly moved, you know, just like I thought. So now they're obviously telepathic.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe takes it a little to get through my brain. So anyway, eventually I... got out and took off and came back the next day for an official swim with the dolphin, and we had our official swim together. She showed me her house, sort of, mm-hmm. and some little algaes and other things she liked. She just showed them to me, and mm-hmm. oh, that's neat,
mm-hmm.
and so on. We're having a great time together. So then I get out of that swim, and I said, hey, wait, what's her name? And I said, oh, she swims with her eyes half closed. We call her Dreamer. So that was my introduction to dreams and dolphins.
Wow. That's a nice story. Well, I know that you guys have been led. You probably had some telepathic encounters as well that brought you to places and things.
Well, the most remarkable is I was pregnant with my second child. 3 weeks before his birth, I was on the beach. I had just come in from being out in the water where the dolphins were. And I got this message that said my baby would be born early. It would be born mid-August. It would be born August 18th at the beach. Well, I went home and wrote this on the computer and then kind of forgot about it. But sure enough, 3 weeks later, August 18th, my baby started to come. And I made my way down to the beach. I was going to be out in the ocean, having him in the ocean with the dolphins. When we got there, there were hundreds of dolphins waiting for us. I was going to be out in the ocean, but he came out foot first, which is kind of an original birthing position for a human, but for a dolphin child, it's perfectly perfect.
Yes.
But because he was human, he had to be delivered on the beach. So he came out with his 1 foot, and then my friend Barbara spiraled him out, got his leg out, his other leg out, which was behind his neck, and then his arm, then his head, and then his other arm. We were on the beach recovering, although it was a pretty easy birth for me, truthfully. When a fisherman, the man who was sitting behind my back, actually going back a moment, a friend was sitting behind my back who had just come in from swimming with the dolphins. And he was coming out of the water saying, "Wow, that was about the best experience I've ever had. I wonder what could possibly top this." And he sees me coming down the cliff and he said, "That lady's about to have her baby and I'm going to help her." He had just come in from being in the water for 2 or 3 hours with the dolphins. They were very voluptuous in front of him. They were doing everything in front of him. And there was a very pregnant female, pregnant one, and he saw her start to give birth.
Wow. Very rare, rare.
Very, very, very rare. It was so rare that he felt it was too sacred for a human even to look upon.
Oh.
And he said, "You know, this is just too sacred. I'm going to leave you now to this." And that's when he came up and saw me coming down the cliff. So he came from the dolphin birth to my child's birth.
Mm-hmm.
And after the baby was born, a fisherman came in from the ocean with his catch. And he said he was all excited because he had just seen a brand new baby dolphin, which was very rare again.
Mm-hmm.
And then he saw my brand new baby dolphin baby. Human dolphin baby. So then we knew that my son had a dolphin twin.
Yes.
And I realized, of course, that the dolphins knew when my baby was coming because, of course, they knew when their baby was coming. And they knew that I would choose to go to the beach to give birth because all along the coast, all the time we had been there for the last year and some months, I've been looking for a place to give birth, to set up our dolphin birthing center. One place was the Hot Pond, which has now become a county park. But if I went there, the dolphins were still somewhere else. It was not possible to have dolphins there. More than anything in the world, I longed to give birth with a dolphin to this child. And so I went to the beach, and lo and behold, there he was born. And they were out there waiting for us, and
that's
it was wonderful.
Kind of a dream-like, intuitional thing that brought you there. Like you said, you got the message, made note of it, but didn't really let
it aside.
Yeah.
All along that gestation, I was directed to totally stay in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I would only know moment to moment what now, which is very powerful. Also a little bit scary for Capricorn, who likes to plan things out, or who in my past life liked to plan things out. Now I know better. But it's to stay present so that whatever was coming, I could be responsive to then. And I was prepared if I had to go to the hospital or something else was going to happen, fine by me. My only outcome was that we both come out well. And we did. It was wonderful. Beautiful birth.
These are the kinds of experiences that you've had, and just by having them, you kind of like establish new territory for human experience. And I think we're all kind of pioneers, and we're foraging and forcing our way into new areas of exploration. We're going where no man has gone before, to try to say that's all right. We can stand in these places and we won't die, we won't get maimed, and it's okay to start to embrace a new way of thinking about the world. The biggest nut that we're facing with, and you labeled it quite accurately when you said that we have this sense of separation that is drilled into us from birth, that is reinforced through our educational system, that is held in place by all of our religious and social institutions. Everything keeps bringing us back to the idea that we are separate from the things around us. And there's no alternative to that. The idea that we can be joined together, we have to wait until we die, in a religious sense, before we get to have that experience. But on the other hand, the dolphins, as a sentient race of beings, have demonstrated what it feels, looks, and is like to be in one envelope, which is the beautiful ocean. They've recognized and gone back into the ocean after millions of years of being land animals, saying, "Hey, there's something going on here that would allow us to evolve a sense of being that is most conducive to a planetary consciousness." So I believe in myself that the dolphins and the whales were the first species on the planet to really to conceive of and begin living on a planetary conscious basis. And all of the evidence now that we have of their existence, their social orders, their structures, their communication abilities, seem to indicate that that's the case.
Yeah.
That they are not a bunch of individuals, although they have individual personalities.
Absolutely.
They are able to understand this big barrier that we haven't quite gotten over, that they're all part of the same soup.
Mm-hmm.
And then in being so, they don't have to fight each other in order to establish their separation. So there's a little rhyme and reason to all of this that's going on. We as humans have to experience the butt end of this to let go of the programming, the neural programming. And oftentimes it's not an easy task. In fact, it's usually very painful because some part of us tends to grip on what we don't understand. We want to hold on to harder and harder. And so,
kind of backwards, huh?
It is, but you know, I think we're kind of like coming in foot first, maybe in this new birthing cycle.
Yeah.
And like the dolphins, we thought that coming in head first was the way it was done, or we'll say as humans, but well, I think we're learning that there's different ways to approach the same subject. Well, let's take a little bit of a break here, a little breather for our audience. We'll take a little musical interlude. I want to turn you on to some of the sonic revelations that Michael is in Paradise have realized with a CD, and we'll talk a little bit about the dolphin song, the dolphin swimmer. I want to talk also about the article that's just come out that's highlighted your work with the dolphins and DNA. So we'll get to that as soon as we come back in just a few moments. So hang in there. We'll be right back. This is Dolphinville Radio. Listening to Dolphinville Radio, dolphinville.com. Mm-hmm. Let's turn our attention to the recent article that's been published as part of a book coming out by Dr. Lee Horowitz. It's called Pirates of the Sacred Spiral, talking about the DNA coding and what we're just now starting to begin to even think about. Now, there's a whole chapter devoted to what you talked about, relationship of the DNA to the dolphins. Can you give us a kind of synopsis of what that is?
Okay. The book is by Dr. Leonard Horowitz. It's called DNA, Pirates of the Sacred Spiral. We have a link up on www.planetpuna.com. It's the top link. It'll take you to some ordering information if you'd like. And I was requested by Dr. Horowitz to write a chapter having to do with dolphins, therapy, and autism, which I did. And he took much of that and incorporated it into his chapter 12, on the modalities of alternate healing and how they work, and gave me a co-author on that 12th chapter, so, which was a wonderful surprise.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm happy to note his work. And a lot of what Dr. Horowitz has researched has much relevance to everything, but in particular, it's a realization that we are structured, packed water, and therefore the water that we're structured by is in a state called liquid crystal. And so the water has memory, structure, and tight bonding. It can still flow, but it remembers things. And if you're a liquid crystal, then you are supremely sensitive to electromagnetic fields and sonic fields, which change the packing, change the structure, and change the memory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, within this is a ethereal scaffolding, if you will, called the DNA, that's essentially patterned by the water, because the water is the major mass of our body. and therefore, in a sense, the DNA is the tail and the packed water is the dog, if you will. And so the DNA is also supremely sensitive to the packing of the water and electromagnetic and acoustic fields around it. And in fact, we now know that it resonates in the acoustic band, the ultrasonic band, and microwave and radio bands, as well as light. So the DNA is like a very long antenna. In fact, the total length of DNA in each one of your cells is something like 6 feet. So
in each cell?
In each cell.
So billions and billions.
And of course, out of this tight coupling between the packed water and the electromagnetic and acoustic environment comes what it is the DNA actually does, what genes are expressed, which ones are on, which ones are off. And Glenn has gathered a whole lot of information about that. So that rather than thinking of the DNA as just this chemical sequence that codes something, it's actually responding and affecting an entire milieu of our environment, instantly, all the time. And that's what needs to be appreciated. Because just the right electromagnetics can turn on and off a gene. That's the fundamental concept. And so in thinking about this, I was wondering how it was that the dolphins could heal autistic people and Down syndrome and cerebral palsy and Dream of the Dolphin, microcephaly, right, and Dream of the Dolphin that I mentioned before in another session happened to fix my neck with about 20 pulses of sonar. But one of the things that got me thinking was it took about an hour for the full effect to come through. And how could that be? And the obvious thing is they can change gene expression. So it turns out in the front of the dolphin is a structure called the melon. And we've recently learned through the work of Eldon Bird and Dean Rawlings that it's piezoelectric, which means when it gets vibrated by sound, it puts out an electric field. And so, roughly, you can call a dolphin, in addition to putting out sound fields that are very strong, like close to a horsepower peak, they also put out electric fields, so that means, in a sense, they're radio transmitters. And there's some people that even think they can communicate over long distances by radio using these techniques. But we've yet to confirm that. But the melon itself can probably put out about 100 watts of electric current.
That's big.
Yeah. And we know that very subtle currents are sufficient to turn off or turn on certain parts of the DNA. Through the work of Ross Aidy, he was able to turn on, for example, what's called an oncogene, a cancer-causing gene. Just as an experiment, if you find the right resonant frequency, you can specifically turn on any gene. And so
technology, Reichian technology,
right.
That uses subtle electronic pulses to positively affect diseased bodies?
Exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now we find that in addition to our new knowledge about how the DNA is sensitive to all these fields, we find out that the dolphins with supreme intelligence can create and control and aim these kind of fields at someone, say, that's in the water with them.
Okay.
And this opens up a tremendous field of study about which we're only scratching the surface, about which I'm mostly totally ignorant. It was mainly the insight that this could be going on. And there's some correlative evidence that medical ultrasound will change gene expression. There's lots of work by Ross Aidy about the electromagnetic fields and how that can change the DNA. And so on. So that's what the chapter in the book are about, largely.
Wow.
And
go ahead.
Back to language sculpting, because our DNA is responsive. You see, this is a new concept, even that DNA could be changed at all. Once what you were born with is what people thought up until very recently you would die with. So the fact that we have influence over our DNA, that consciousness, our own consciousness, or external things could make a difference is new. But language sculpting, because it's about coherent fields of energy, also makes a difference on our genetic expression as well. And this is something that we're looking to further document, actually, that the input, internal input, from our thinking to our linguistic structures are also going to be making a difference on us. And when the dolphins swim with pregnant ladies, I had an experience some years ago. I just finished doing a talk one night about, quote, unconditional love for a friend of mine. Anyway, we sculpted that to complete love, zero conditional love, just complete love, pure love. A lady came in, she had just been swimming at our beach with a dolphin, she was pregnant, And as soon as she told me that, I saw that the dolphins had come around her, and what they were doing with all their sonar stuff was they were, in a sense, cleaning up the baby's DNA. They were fine-tuning it, they were finessing it, they were upgrading it, if you will. And one thing that we're very interested in exploring is, what's different about children who've had in utero experience with the dolphins? We'd like to do a study as part of our work to find out, and now we have some places from around the world,
sure.
The Russian,
sure.
Israel, even Hawaiian children have been born many years ago with dolphins.
I heard that. You mentioned that earlier, which I think is phenomenal when you consider that there is very little Hawaiian history relative to visitations. Not one chant, not one petroglyph, not one ancient dance that is a specific to the cetaceans. No amakuas, nothing except kind of like a hearsay.
Well, actually, in the creation chant, it does make reference to their ancestors, the whales. So the earliest reference is to the great whales as an amakua, as their creators in the creation chant.
Because somebody speculated that the whales weren't even around Hawaii some 300 years ago.
Well,
You would think, why would that be? You know,
the creation chant is very old.
Right, right.
And we have a friend who's...
It's Polynesian more than Hawaiian, you're saying. Or
specifically, this is the Hawaiian creation chant.
Uh-huh.
And we have a friend who's involved with the sovereignty movement who actually went to federal court and claiming ancestry to his amakua, the humpback whales, requested through legal channels that he be informed whenever the Navy was going to come and do their sonar testing so that he could make arrangements to alert his people, to speak.
The whales.
And they got that permission granted.
They did?
Yes.
When was this? This is phenomenal.
It was when everyone was going to Oahu, when Lanny was doing that big thing, when Cheryl came over and all of that. It was around that time.
Okay.
And we could get you the exact source.
No, it's okay. I love the idea because I always thought it was interesting that there wasn't any real collaborative history.
Uh-huh.
But we can turn back and say, well, we have plenty of amakua shark and turtle, lizard, hawk, all of these totems.
Mm-hmm.
But where's the dolphin and the whale?
Well, one of our informants said, when I asked her about this, they said, oh, yes, we've been doing this for years. I said, well, we've heard very little about it except for this one story. I said, well, we're very quiet about it.
Yeah.
And I said,
we're happy you're doing it.
Yeah. But, yes, what do you think about what we're doing? They said, yes, it's your job to make it more public, and that's great. You know, go for it. But basically, it was a long-term relationship, but they're just very quiet about what they actually are doing.
You see a cultural change as part of the dolphinization. You see a great oneness as the vision of the unfolding. How would you describe that to our listeners, the great oneness?
Well, the great oneness is actually a sculpt. In the Lily tradition, there was a thing on their fridge in Malibu having saying something to the effect that, and that ends the great aloneness.
There you are.
Although, in sculpting terms, what we seek to do is to create a new reality through our words, to create a new world out of the etheric through the vibration. In saying ending the great aloneness, we still have the thought form of great aloneness. And I sculpted that to beginning the great oneness. The great oneness, because it's what happened with me when I met the cetacea, when I met the dolphins for the first time. I felt connected. I felt connected for the first time in my life, and only after feeling connected did I truly understand that I had felt so alone and apart from everything my whole life up until then. This was a profound awakening for me and changed my whole life. So the great oneness is about what happens when we on Earth, we humans in particular, feel part of life. When we feel connected, when I felt connected, even though I was a kind, nice person all along anyway, it then became another level of engagement with my world and with people. It was impossible for me to continue in that old mindset, that perceived separation. I realized that, you know, just little modest things. But for an example, seeing, you know, trash on the ground. Okay, well, now I'm obliged. feel obliged. I want to pick it up. I want to clean it up. I want to be more a part of making my earth home, making my mother home, being more sentient about caring about my words and my influence in the world, understanding that even though I was one of, at that time, maybe 5 billion people on the planet, that because we're all connected, that whatever I was thinking, feeling, experiencing, putting out, in addition to touching the vibrational consciousness of the world, in fact, went through all of creation, which is pretty amazing to be that much a part of everything. And even though, like, the numbers, like, billions and trillions of stars and galaxies was like, wow, that's a lot. I was still empowered because my being was able to touch all of that.
Yeah.
And then it became a quest, if you will, to be more conscious as much as possible of what I was putting out. And God bless me, I've done my utmost. Mm. Although I've fallen short of my own mark sometimes, to be sure. But at least
you even allow that to be in your language.
And the prayer, the intention and the prayer of and the desire to put out the highest best I can, knowing that I'm reaching everything, has been with me ever since.
Mm-hmm.
This has been a profound influence that the dolphins are directly responsible for. This was my great oneness that started and continues to this day.
Well, that's a wonderful story, and I think it's a great foundation of a philosophy that ties you guys together. Let's turn our attention a little bit to some of the techno stuff. You created a CD. What is the CD? It has to do with sounds and energy. How did it came about, and how can we get some?
Okay. There's a link to our CD off of Planet Puna.
Okay.
It says something like order our CD. PayPal link. They'll get one CD with three tracks. The first is a digitally recorded humpback song. Thank you. that went on for some time off Kihei, Maui. And then the second track is a section in which they primarily are triggering a MIDI synthesizer. So we gave them a musical instrument they could play. And then the third track is a transformation of a set of dolphin whistles that were going on at the Hyatt Waikoloa, that's now the Hilton Waikoloa, on the Big Island on the Kona side, where they have several dolphins.
These are the dolphins that are part of the facility of Dolphin Quest over
right,
there.
That's correct. And Dr. Ray Stone was kind enough to let us record her dolphins one day on Valentine's Day, just before a dolphin conference, one of the ICERC conferences that was on the Kona site, and we recorded the dolphins, then ran it through what's called a pitch tracker, which responds to the pitch of the signal coming in, and depending on the pitch, sets out a number, say from 0 to 127, from low to high pitch, and then that can be picked up and sent through a musical synthesizer, a MIDI, Musical Industry Digital Interface. Fairly simple stuff in a way. You can get it off the shelf.
Sure.
And so essentially, if the dolphin goes, you can get now, say, a cello sound or a violin sound that goes wow wow in the same pitch profile.
Gotcha.
And that's it.
All right.
It's that simple. And so we did this with the humpbacks as well. So they're at sea. We have a hydrophone and an underwater speaker. So the humpbacks would do something like wow wow. And then that would be picked up by this synthesizer system and put back out as cello in the same frequency. Wow, wow. And they got to hear that. Now, I think they were ringing it out. They were playing with it. And at one point, several of the humpbacks take this big breath, and you can hear that on the tape, and then they do something.
Wow.
And it sends the entire system into feedback resonance. It goes on for many seconds.
Yes.
And it's like they knew exactly the transfer function of this device. They knew exactly its time delays, its frequency, and everything. And they whacked it with a signal that would cause it to feedback and resonate. And then they kind of lost interest, but they were still playing with it after that. That was kind of a climax.
Now, this leads me to the question. Sirius Institute, we're referring to the planet Sirius. Ancient Dogon legend has that there was a dolphin-human species that descended from the stars millennia ago, bringing with them an awareness, a knowledge about this star system. They wrote in their tribal customs, and they described the star system Sirius A and B before we even knew that a Sirius A and B existed. Telling us on some level that either they could, in their dream time, reach across space and have an understanding, or that there was an intelligence that was able to project over time and space to come here and give us a hint. Now that we've reached a level where we're beginning, just beginning, the new birth of a planetary awareness, we are starting to get hints that there's a whole pantheon of entities sitting out there going, I wonder if they'll make it. Have you had any experiences with the so-called ET?
I've seen some strange things in the sky that seem possibly to be craft.
No dream time connection on that level. Okay, you're
saying that has.
I consider
the dolphins, since they live in the water, they're extraterrestrial.
Absolutely. They are definitely extraterrestrial.
And definitely I've had some very deep thoughts and visions about whether they're connected with Sirius, and while there's yet to be much scientific way of confirming this, it's my personal opinion that there's a lot to it. The Temple's book called The Sirius Mystery is the best documented case of extraterrestrial contact in the past. And if it were just the Dogon, there are some wiggles about that story that you can gripe about. However, Temple really extends it to about six other cultures. And from other data we have, it extends to the Hopi, for example. They have the Blue Star Kachina. And they called 1994, I believe it was. I think it was 1994. Was called the Year of Sirius among the Hopis.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
They
that's
drummed for the entire
out.
Year. They stopped on April 23rd. April 23rd happened to be the closest approach of Sirius B to Sirius A.
Uh-huh.
So that ties the entire thing into the Hopi tradition.
Okay.
Now, other Native American people and others that we've talked to,
mm-hmm.
their elders have been getting together and comparing notes.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically say, when they get it all sorted out, it's the same story.
Wow.
Which means what Temple has started uncovering mm-hmm. is a global story that everybody
Mm-hmm.
So it has little to do with whether the Dogon details are yeah. correct or anything else. It's mm-hmm. a global tradition.
Go ahead.
I'd like to address that. When we first came to Maui, shortly after January of 1991, I had a dream one night in which I saw that dolphins manipulated their own genetics and were able to actually create a human in utero in their own kind. And then we came out of them and came to the land. There is a very deep part of me that I experience every so often that shows me that we are their other self, if
mm-hmm.
you will.
Mm-hmm.
That after all those millions of years of being a group consciousness, that's all they knew.
Mm.
And through creating us and for a sense of, more than a sense of, for the completion of the process, if you will, they had to go from a whole group consciousness to the separation consciousness that so embodies the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And through our reawakening, through our reconnecting and regenerating the great oneness,
mm-hmm.
they would come to know through us the wholeness of it all.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the light knowing the dark
mm-hmm.
and loving it by being one with it again.
Mm-hmm.
They would come to know everything that we know through us.
Mm-hmm.
And we would be their land equivalent. But now we come through our experience, through our great wealth of experience, of separation, of all that that has meant to us, and all it has meant to the garden
mm-hmm.
of paradise, and all it means even at the galactic level,
mm-hmm.
that we are a great experiment here,
mm-hmm.
that we would go into this great, again, separation, darkness, whatever we want to call it, but come through that with tremendous wisdom, through tremendous learning and the application of our hearts and compassion, and to bring this back to the fold,
mm.
to begin the journey home,
mm.
the homecoming, to bring our planet back
mm-hmm.
to the center where we are,
mm-hmm.
you know, but to come back with that new being,
mm-hmm.
the new human, the new galactic human, that comes in now and is ready to take our place
mm-hmm.
at that galactic table. When you asked about, like, did we have UFO experiences?
Mm-hmm.
When I was on television, one of the last shows I did was a one-hour live special. It was called our Intergalactic Broadcast. Being newly inspired just for about 3 years with a dolphin within, I was inspired to do this show and to share, and it was on Cosmic Wish Day. It was the Jupiter-Sun conjunction and March of 1986
mm-hmm.
and to share through my guests that Earth was starting to awaken into a higher consciousness mm-hmm. and that indeed the dolphins through the Sirius connection had come to show us the way home
mm-hmm.
and they were the sponsors of the show through the Sirius Broadcasting Network. It was all for fun, but it was also quite serious, if
yeah.
you will. And we that's how it came about, though, is I swam with Joe and Rosie and Roberta
mm-hmm.
down at Dolphins Plus, and as I drove cross-country on my own, totally inspired, totally activated
mm-hmm.
by my encounter,
mm-hmm.
I wondered, well, what am I going to do with all of this now, and what's coming out of this, and what came was the Sirius connection, which was then incorporated as a vehicle to launch my dolphin dreams, my films, my videos,
mm-hmm.
my movies, my books, my everything.
Yes.
I was so full of, like, wow, the dolphins are here.
Right.
And I'm part of it.
Hmm. So we still need those videos and books and cards
yes.
and DVDs. And this is part of what the Sirius Institute, this is the 21st Century Sirius Institute's projects. You've been here since 1991, celebrating the eclipse, and the eclipse of a new way of thinking on the planet. And it's time now for us to begin to brew this new vision. The next 7 years is going to be vitally important. people such as us who have shared and gone through the tough part. We have this little opportunity where we've been sharing it today to see what it feels like, what it tastes like to sit in this place of the now, to taste what it's like to be on this beautiful shoreline. Whales will be here in a matter of minutes. We know they're out there already. We've heard their...
Whalesong.org.
Whalesong.org. Yes.
I just want to say that last year for Earth Day, we were at the university celebrating Earth Day, and we had live whale songs, thanks to whalesong.org, for the first time at an Earth Day celebration. And we had some of our favorite musicians, Randy Matos and Tony Sauvage, playing music with us, with the whales, for the first time ever, a live encounter. And this is part of our work towards establishing music as a common language interface, which is part of what the Song Swimmer is about.
Well, the Song Swimmer, and how does this differ, say, than what Jim Nolman has been trying to do?
Jim Nolman has done wonderful work, and he certainly was an inspiration to everything I was thinking. But basically, I ended up with a shaman name that translates as Song Swimmer. And I kept thinking about that, like, what does the name mean? And
what is the name? Pronounce it for us.
Well, the short version is Song Swimmer. But, singing swimming man calls the dawn.
Okay, I like that.
There you go.
It's kind of hard to drag that out. Is that a bad word or something?
It's embarrassing for a scientist. I was talking to Pat Flanagan once, and he's a marvelous scientist, done some things with the water and the neurophone.
Yeah.
It turns out he was teaching dolphins Hawaiian about 50 years ago now with Wayne Bateau. Basically, he and Wayne Bateau came up with a frequency shifter so you could speak Hawaiian into a microphone. It would be shifted to about 50 kilohertz. And heard as a high whistle by the dolphins.
Curious.
And they had them up to where the dolphins were understanding on the order of 40 words in Hawaiian.
Curiously, we know that Hawaiian is a tonal language.
Right.
So I think this is curious.
Yes, so it is relevant to what I'm saying. But just to talk about this briefly,
yes.
After I talked with him once on the phone for an hour and a half, he says to me, why'd you call your organization the Sirius Institute? I'm going, it's all legend and on. So while I'm delaying and hemming and hawing, he laughs on the other end and says, I think they're from Sirius, too.
Seriously, yeah.
So anyway, on we go. But it'd be nice to have data as a scientist to show all this. At the moment, it's speculation in a sense. However, back to the point here. The Song Swimmer, then, is a musical interface because the dolphins and the orcas, the humpbacks, and all the others we've checked, communicate at least in part in musical phrases. The humpbacks understand musical keys. Like there was a musician, Paul Gilman, that played to the different groups of humpbacks. After he realized they were singing in different keys, he would play in those keys, and only that group would answer. And at the time, he was with a scientist named Joseph Mobley, who basically thought of them as kind of big, dumb cow type things.
Sure.
Right? And it flat out blew the biologist's mind that they understood the keys of music. You know, so that'll give you some idea where the biologists are versus where they really are. So it got
It was 2 years ago or maybe 3 years ago that the cover of Newsweek said, scientists believe animals have emotions. I went, hello? These guys never had a dog?
Yeah, you know, that's what they said. So, in any case, it became clear that if we had some sort of musical involvement, then we could have a concert, and we can also turn that into a linear communication means. So, we found out that their music can be described by something called the Harrison-Lucy scale. It was originally invented by John Harrison, who invented the first clocks that would work on ships, and happened to be the way that Captain Cook found Hawaii. He also invented a scale of music called the Harrison scale, and it turns out when we analyze the orca sounds, dolphin sounds, and humpback sounds, that scale description matches them much better than ET, or equal temperament, rather. So we now know how to tune our instruments to be in tune with the dolphins. That's number one. So part of it is musical. We know what the scale is, and now we can make an interface. Now, the simplest way has to do something like this. Hawaiian has only 14 sounds, basic sounds in it. So you can represent it by 14 notes. The dolphins have nearly perfect pitch, they have perfect pitch. They can set out two dolphins, for example, one dolphin can start a whistle. And halfway through it, another dolphin picks it up and finishes it.
Perfect.
And they're completely in phase.
Sure.
No, the transition, unless you had two hydrophones to show that the sound was coming from a different place, you'd think it was one dolphin.
Wow.
They're that clever, that precise. So, they have perfect pitch. So, you assign 13 frequencies, one for each of the sounds of Hawaiian. When the dolphins create that frequency, the computer picks that up and puts out a phoneme. Etc. Until you have a speech synthesizer. The general term is a vocoder.
Yes.
So they speak a series of frequencies. And out comes Hawaiian. Aloha. That kind of thing.
Has that actually happened?
Well, Patel was working on that sort of thing, mm-hmm. in the sense that they shifted the human voice to the dolphin range, mm-hmm. and they spoke Hawaiian because it was the minimum number of phonemes to create an intermediate communication means. Sadly, Bateau seems to have died of a heart attack while swimming. The project was canceled and then picked up by the Navy in a classified mode, and so we've yet to find out what happened after that. Presumably, the Navy continued the work, and what we know from the Russian work, especially by a paper called by Markov and Ostrakaya, they analyzed 300,000 vocalizations of the dolphins and very briefly concluded they have a language. They've figured out some of the syntax. We've yet to know what the meaning is. It's definitely a language. It definitely carries information. And it has a potential vocabulary of something like a trillion symbols. Whether they use all those, we've yet to know. But they use a lot of them. And since a dolphin is able to put out at least four sounds simultaneously, all different, like four click tracks all different, four whistles all different, or any combination, they can fiddle with the harmonic envelope, they do all kinds of things, and all with four separate sources. And with that kind of technology, they could focus, say, a megahertz, a million cycle a second signal down to something smaller than a millimeter, mm-hmm. and punch it with a power of about a horsepower. So that's enough to, say, boil water 8 feet from the beak.
They certainly stun like fish.
Yeah, and they stun fish. Right, and they stun fish, and they fix people's necks like my own, and, mm-hmm. and somehow fix microcephaly and improve autism and Down syndrome.
Yes.
And they're doing something very profound with all this.
They understand wave technology
right.
to the nth degree.
So where was I going with this? So the sound swimmer basically is a pitch tracker coupled with a computer and a speech synthesizer so that we can come up with some objective intermediate code. Of course, we have a language, probably primitive compared to theirs.
Mm-hmm.
They have a language. It's so different than ours that we've yet to understand how it works, even, or what it means.
Well, we don't know what they're talking about.
Right, exactly. But we know they're talking, and we know they have a language, we know they have a syntax, and we know they have a vocabulary.
Yes.
So, let's build the simplest interface.
Sure.
14 sounds going to 14 phonemes allows them to speak Hawaiian. We can speak back and forth. And now, this opens up the next stage, which is to make a teaching machine.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it's a sound-operated computer based on this kind of technology. Think of an acoustic mouse.
Sure.
So that the dolphins can run a computer, or even the whales.
Sure.
They could go on the internet, you know, but the basic idea is give them a machine they can run, and then give them the technology so that they can show us what they think we ought to know.
Wow.
Because obviously, we are the ones that have the smaller brain, the shorter evolutionary history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We can hardly swim, we can hardly see, we can hardly jump compared to a dolphin.
Sure.
Okay.
Can hardly think.
Maybe we can hardly think.
This leads us to the concept of the cetacean commonwealth.
Oh, right. Well, just to finish it, was the idea is we need a teaching machine, mm-hmm. so the cetacea can teach us what they think we ought to know, which is, to my knowledge, a new approach.
And that's what I'm saying. It segues perfectly into the concept of the cetacean commonwealth, which is that if we can find the technology to establish a communicative link so that we can exchange this information. And is in some of the literature that we've talked about, Ken Brinwood's book, which is a beautiful dream of man and human and cetaceans working together.
Mm-hmm.
How does that shape itself to describe the cetacean commonwealth that you envisioned?
Well, the commonwealth was inspired when we were in Los Angeles nearly 4 years ago. We showed up in January. Michael had already been there for a while, so my son and I made it over. And we had presented to the Malibu City Council an offer of like a sister city or an Aloha City kind of relationship, giving them acknowledgement for having established the human cetacean resolution, making the dolphins citizens of Malibu.
Mm-hmm.
This was a very exciting first thing, and it had happened in the 80s to a lady named Mary. And so we made our presentation before City Council, wound up staying there a bit longer, were invited to stay for Earth Day.
Mm-hmm.
In there somewhere, thinking, and this was at a time when the LFAS stuff was pretty hefty, and in fact, our county council had that, just before we went to their city council, had passed the resolution through the Greens, making this like a LFAS zero zone,
mm-hmm.
okay, to preserve their well-being.
Which means they don't tell us.
It means, well, they have to have a little bit, they have to at least like alert us, and so we can tell them through telepathy to stay away.
I think at least from the Navy standpoint, well, we just won't tell you now.
Well, except we saw what happened on July 4th when that happened in Hanalei Bay, which we've had a chance to talk about like on the Jeff French show in Radio Orbit. But the Cetacean Commonwealth came as a mechanism, if you will, whereby humans like ourselves who were willing, able, and in a sense designated to speak on behalf of the people of the sea.
Mm-hmm.
We'd pick up that gauntlet until such time as we had, we or whoever, established effective two-way communication so they could speak on their own behalf.
Mm-hmm.
But we know for sure that they want quiet water.
Mm-hmm.
They want clean water. They want to be left alone. They
obvious
want to
things.
Be preserved and thrive and prosper their numbers and to be around for the next evolution of our planet.
To the Cetacean Nation as being the resonant sound of the clarion call. Wake up. Start acknowledging that this is a species that if we look at all of these things that we've talked about, the concept that we're not alone in the universe, the concept that we are sharing this biosphere with another intelligent species, the concept that maybe if we would shut up long enough and start to listen, they could tell us some things about how to conduct ourselves. And as we become quiet inside, metaphysically starting to listen to our own pulse beats from the inside out, then the resonant tones, the tonal language that is all around us, becomes a new reality. And these things that you guys are bridge makers, now we can take it to the next level. So the Commonwealth, the Cetacean Nation, is all very much part of the reality.
Well, it is very much part of it. It's really tagging or following through on John Lilly's great vision, which was to have the peoples of the sea, the Cetacean Nations, jointly accepted as a legitimate peoples through the United Nations, through the World Court, through the peoples of the world, which would lead to a whole new beginning for our planet.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I experienced was personally and collectively the great aloneness, the tremendous separation our beautiful Gaia feels in the midst of all of creation, in the midst of all these stars and planets, and the feeling that we are alone. And the tremendous anguish that creates in us as a consciousness. So through creating something that brings us together,
mm-hmm.
it brings us back into the matrix of all of creation,
mm-hmm.
where again that great oneness can really take hold. And through that, we can learn about the true story of who we are on this planet as Earth humans. How did we come to be here? What happened when these comets came and hit the Earth? How did the dinosaurs really leave? How did we come to be in this position where we are today, poised to make a tremendous leap across that consciousness into unity thinking, into unity life? I wanted to know this as much or more than anything else. And I know through the feeling state that I would go into the deep stillness, I could feel this longing all around me that we just wanted to be part of it all.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to be on the inside sharing what was real.
Mm-hmm.
And this work is really dedicated to that and to continuing John and Tony Lilly's great work to bring their awareness, to bring their intelligence, to bring who they truly are to us as humans, to the collective consciousness, to be some of many, because there are people throughout the world who have been touched by the Lily Touch.
Indeed.
including you.
Well, I just acknowledge John and Tony up there from the other side of the reality matrix, as they're, I'm sure, still looking down on us and nodding appreciatively. It's been fun sharing the time with you guys. And hopefully it's just the tip of the iceberg for people who have questions and they want to go to the Sirius Institute. Today is the 13th anniversary of...
the celebrating of the gathering of the partners of the Sirius Institute, which was initiated 13 years ago in Opihikau, when two of our other partners just coincidentally showed up on November 23rd.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wait a minute, we ought to celebrate the gathering of the partners. From that day forward, on the 23rd of every month, we celebrate the gathering, you know, in a more casual kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the number 23 relates to Sirius, the dog star in the sacred traditions. And according to Coming Full Circle with Michael, mm-hmm. Robert Anton Wilson and all of his great work.
Wow, love the Rob.
So today, it's so perfectly appropriate because we had attempted to schedule this communication between us a few times already.
Mm-hmm.
But it happens today on November 23rd, 2004, our 13th annual gathering of the partners of the Sirius Institute.
And 13, to be acknowledged, as a very magical number.
Fibonacci
sequence. And just acknowledging, here we are. Thank you, both of you guys.
Mahalo to you, Douglas.
And some closing thoughts, Michael?
Yes. Carl Jung said that the only way we were going to have an objective understanding of what we were as humans was to communicate either with the higher mammals or the extraterrestrials. So it's a very important thing to do. And I just wanted to mention very quickly that we've had a long history together. As you know, with the Greeks, very quickly they shared their psychedelic sacraments with the dolphins after fishing, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They considered the dolphins the highest form of physical creation. And so there are many peoples, like in Mauritania and Australia and so on, that still maintain that partnership with the cetacea.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a long one. The Polynesians, for example, have legends of how the whales and the dolphins guided the canoes,
mm-hmm.
and so on and so forth. I could go on for a long time. So, in a sense, the great oneness that we're wanting to have has been here, and we're just remembering it.
Coming back full circle. Thank you both for full circles in advance. This is Dolphin Dolphinus. I will see you next time. Be well and swim free.
You've been listening to Dolphinville Radio, www.dolphinville.com. Thanks for listening.
Communication.